Hi, I'm Gordon Lamphere, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers who are shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with A.K. Schultz. A.K. is CEO of SVT Robotics, the platform helping industrial companies integrate automation without blowing up their IT stack. We break down the multi-trillion dollar automation opportunity that is still in its infancy. We debate greenfield versus brownfield. We reveal why just four walls and a roof won't cut it in real estate anymore, and how some businesses are saving 60% by eliminating operational inefficiencies. Real estate investors and operators, if you want to future-proof your investment, you'll want to take notes. AK, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So why robotics?
Why robotics? Is that a question of why I joined robotics, or just more of the metaphysical why robotics for anybody?
We can start with why you joined robotics, and then we can get into the metaphysical afterwards.
So just to pre-qualify, I have a long and meandering career, right? So it actually started when I was an Army officer. I was in tanks and reconnaissance. And airborne, and so the natural thing to do when you leave that is to go into and be a nuclear engineer. And so once I left the Army, I became a nuclear engineer, and which is a fascinating field. I was working on the aircraft carrier side of building reactors, and but the technology was essentially the same since the 1950s. And it was more about risk management. And me as a person who likes to create wasn't really my place. Like, it wasn't my goal. And I mean, it's an amazing profession. I have total respect for everybody. I learned a ton about quality management, but I wasn't really on the edge of where I needed to be. And the nuclear industry is essentially more risk adverse, and great people, amazing quality systems, but there's a natural tendency towards biasing away from innovation towards risk management, which is what we want from nuclear reactors. Let's just be clear. But but for me, it was not the forever home. And so one day I was getting my MBA, and I got headhunted by the Swiss company that wanted somebody who was a US-based person, because they had just landed a massive contract with a very, very large company based in Arkansas. You may know them. And and the Europeans don't really speak Arkansas. So, like, I guess they needed somebody from south of the Mason-Dixon line to kind of be this natural translator. But they took me to the interview at a chainsaw factory, and they showed me a forklift driving itself. And this was in 2004, right? So this is 21 years ago. And I was just blown away. I said, this is where I need to be, right? And so I've been doing it since 2004. It has been just an amazing career to grow up and watch the field evolve. And what's also amazing to me is that been doing this for 20 years, and we're still in early innings, right? We are just scratching the surface. And the things that we can do now, just the advancements, first in machine learning and now into AI, it's an exciting time to be in this business.
So why do you think we're in the early innings of the robotics and data revolution?
Penetration of, like, the market. I think the last stat that I saw was something like 15% of all, say, warehouses have some form of automation, and usually that's like conveyor, right? I mean, just really kind of lower end automation. So we are. And the number of companies that are actually doing advanced stuff, it's really not that many. And so, but they're breaking the ground for everybody else, and they're, You know, so it's, I'd say we're not even to the early majority, right? We're still in early adopter, innovators and early adopters right now.
And so when we're talking about adopting technology, one of the biggest things that we get hung up on, I think, is kind of the start of that process. And one of the big debates that you see overwhelmingly is, can we adopt it in a greenfield versus like a brownfield world? And what do you think the challenge is with that? Do you think we're seeing, you know, adaptation is going to end up being all greenfield or a real brownfield?
So I would argue, some would argue that, hey, it's easier to do it in greenfield because you have a blank slate. And that is true. However, there's a few things that I would say. It sounds like less risky, but in some ways it's more risky. And when you're building something with a building, you tend to think in waterfall, like everything needs to be specified and planned perfectly. The reality is, if it's a 3-year build cycle, the stuff that you're designing in year one is not likely. It's, I mean, 3 years from now, what's the tech going to look like? Right. So the advantage of having a blank slate, by the time it's built, it may be obsolete, irrelevant, or your business may have started to change.
Yeah.
I mean, people, it seems less risky, but it, in a way, it is almost more risky. And because of the amount of money being spent, it ratchets the risk up.
Yeah.
And the visibility. The other thing is brownfield. I mean, that's where all the juice is, right? That's where all the ROI is in brownfield, because the money is in your existing operation. And a lot of times, and this is probably not great for a real estate podcast, but like a lot of times you can do building avoidance.
Yeah.
You can do things that prevent you from saving an entire building. And yes, it'll save money in the operational cost, but you may avoid a $100 million building.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So like, there's now, but there's also challenges, right? So like, one of the challenges is, you have to bring something into an existing operation, and it's kind of like an organ transplant. Sometimes the person rejects the organ, right? It is change management for an existing building without any automation. You really have to not just technically deploy, you have to operationally integrate this thing and really kind of win the hearts and minds of the team that is now taking this on, because, you know, one day their job was X and now it's like, now I got to learn how to do this. And it not everyone is super excited to do that. So there's pros and cons. I would say if you look at the more successful robotics companies, so I'd say the two highest traction new industry, like the newer tech, Locus Robotics and AutoStore. These things are easily dropped into an existing facility with relatively low pain, right? And, you know, I would say, and that's frankly, I think, why they've had so much traction, is because the market is just so much bigger than the greenfield market. I mean, how many buildings are built a year, right? Versus how many are already there. It's like 50,000 houses in the United States or something like that. I mean, I you would probably know the number more better than me. I'd be curious to know what it is, but is it 1,000 buildings built a year? I don't know.
I mean, particularly now that as we go into this high interest rate cycle, the amount of buildings is substantially muted compared to even 2 or 3 years ago. So what we've seen, at least the application of robotics, is overwhelmingly in Class A buildings that were built in the last 10 years.
Yep.
That, you know, people aren't necessarily building fresh, particularly when it costs $200 or $300 a foot sometimes to build new. When you can buy maybe at a, you know, still a pricey, you know, maybe $100 a foot, or, you know, depending on the market, maybe closer to 150. You know, why would you, you know, reduce your profit by 25%, right? So in terms of that, one of the things that we often hear is like, how do you integrate? And I think the biggest question that we usually get is, how do you have the information to know what the right integration process is? And how do you turn like a brownfield building into the right structure with like the current data systems that we have?
Yeah, honestly, that's a great question. It's, to be a little windy on this question.
Wind away. That's fine.
So before the call, I learned that you're a sailor. I'm a sailor, right? So I'm in a different level than you. Like, I'm not on the U.S. national team. We race for rum bottles, as you can tell on the top of my shelf there. So
that's as good a trophy as any.
Exactly. And some of them are not completely full, if you notice. So, there's a utility associated with those trophies. But, the thing that I love about sailing is there's so much science behind a sailboat. It's really an airplane with one wing in the water and one wing in the air, right? And to be a great sailor, I think you really need to understand the physics of what's happening. You need to understand the hydrodynamics, the aerodynamics, right? You need to understand all the mechanics. But at the end of the day, you have to feel it, right? There is an art to it as much as there is a science. And it's at the intersection of the art and science that where the magic happens. And it's what separates someone who's decent from someone who's great, right? And if you have the art but not the science, there's a level you can ascend to. And if you have the science but not the art, there's a level you can ascend to. But if you can pull it all together, you can really make some magic happen. And when I look at this as the same thing, right? So like, there is a lot of complex technical activities you got to do, right? There's stuff that is this hard, and frankly, we've built a platform to abstract that. A lot of those technical difficulties away. But at the end of the day, you're walking into someone's operation and you got to understand what they do. You got to understand what's there, right? You got to understand what's important, what's not important, and then help people and guide them through this process of onboarding this tech. And so, I think the best companies know how to, they are technically skilled, right? You got to be technically skilled, but you also have to understand people. You have to understand businesses. You need to understand this. Companies are these complex organisms, right? And these complex organisms can sometimes be annoying, right? Like, we just want to do the technical thing, right? That unfortunately that never works. And if you ignore the human element, the business element, then you are probably going to fail. So that was my meandery answer.
So I'm going to follow up on that, and I think that's a great analogy for what we've seen in terms of implementation. Where do you tend to see some of the most common pain points in the implementation process? Just as to use your sailing analogy, there are often certain pain points that happen in a race. What are the most common pain points that you see implementing robotics?
So the number one challenge that I see is when a company does not have any veterans on the team who haven't done anything, right? So like, it's because the companies that are doing the most right now in the industry, especially with like, I'd say robotics, it hit a slowdown because of the cap, like just the interest rates alone.
Yeah.
Slowed the robotics market down. But the big players, the ones with a lot of experience, they have not slowed down a lick and they've bought up a lot of the capacity. And it's so easy. It's so much better. Like, you would think that it's easier to work with like a company that's really good at their job might be harder. They may be more persnickety, but it's a pleasure to work with companies that are like that. It's also great to work with a company that is getting started, is keenly aware of what the gap is in their own company, has a good self-awareness, and is leaning into learning. The hard ones are the ones that they have no awareness of how, what their gap is. And sometimes they have almost a casualness or an arrogance about implementation. And they also expect things to be magic, and it's not magic, right? You know, just like, well, I thought you were just going to push a button. Well, it doesn't exactly work that way. So you know, it's great to work with people who understand and respect the problem statement, because it is a very difficult problem. The other thing is, the more mature companies will have an appreciation for the ongoing cost of ownership, the total cost of ownership. You know, like, let's fake it. Like, writing integration code is not that hard. Right. If I can make two things talk to each other, pass messages, no big deal. Right. So integration code is not hard. So why build a platform that does it? Well, because having low technical debt, low cost of ownership, integration approach that is also enables you to consistently and upgrade Kubernetes or whatever the software is in the background, it doesn't affect the robot company on the other side, where you have these cascading upgrades, right? Like, you know, just that alone, if you can't upgrade at will on the individual pieces, you're exposing yourself to cybersecurity threat.
Yeah. Right?
So like, that is hard. That is not trivial. And you have to have a strategy in place, and you have to have a sound technical approach for the long view. And so
can you dive into that a little bit more for some of our listeners that might not fully understand how an elaborate set of layers can be a cybersecurity threat?
Yeah. So so what I see is, when you connect two things together, that's, you know, not a big deal. And if one system has to change, and by the way, when the definition of integration, the literal definition is to make two things into a common whole, right? So that means that if I'm a robot and you're a enterprise like SAP, if we now have become a whole, if you want to upgrade, you have to ask me. I have to do something, right? That's tough when you have now someone else, another party, that is even tougher. And so when you get to five systems interlinked, there's something, it just goes off the scale. It's like you can create just deadlock in this upgrade cycle, because not everyone can just upgrade at the same time. So you're waiting for everyone to be ready, and this could take years, right? It's like terrible. And so there's this concept called abstraction. And what you want is to build things that are abstracted from each other, which means that you can upgrade when you want, I can upgrade when I want, and I'm not going to cause any problems around us, right? You know, doing that it's what you have to have something designed that's designed to act that way. And in the old days, when you only had one robot or a couple of robots, or the robots were like standalone, they didn't do any, they didn't communicate with the host system. Yeah, no big deal. All right. But, you know, but now, like, with so much stuff interlinked, it becomes way harder. And, you know, if you look at like your iPhone, right? All the iPhone, MacBook, all these things are so tied together and interlinked that they all kind of cascade. Imagine doing that, except for any phone manufacturer, any any laptop manufacturer, or any earbud manufacturer. You have to have these standards in place, or these approaches in place, and things like Bluetooth and USB. These are the things that are foundational that enable this upgradability.
So when we're talking about upgradability, one of the biggest things that I often hear our clients ask us when they discuss robotics is, what are the problems that robotics solves, and what does robotics upgrade the most about your facility? So I'm curious, what would you say generally robotics right now is the best at problem solving?
So there's really labor, and there's inventory, and there's real estate, I think are probably the big three, right? There's probably some others like energy, but I think those are the big three. So like, let's just say auto store, that brings a density play. You can take all these small, you know, like you have 10 items in a place, and instead of taking up an entire pallet location, it's taking up a box, right? This big, right? So you can increase the density in your warehouse. Also, you can build something in a normal height building. You don't need a super high building. If you look at, say, Locus, right? Locus is attacking the labor side. And then inventory, if you can hold lower days on hand, then you can save on your inventory cost if you can predictably still fulfill your order. So three, right? So I mean, I would say real estate and labor are probably the top of the page. There actually is one more, and that's speed to fulfill on time reliably. And that's actually what Amazon revolutionized.
Yeah.
Right. Having a million SKUs under one roof, which at one time was like unheard of, like impossible to comprehend. Right. And being able to ship an item in under 45 minutes. Right. Like, think about just a million, walk across a million square foot building. How long does that take you?
I know it's insane. I've seen their facility in Kenosha, and it is unbelievable walking through that place.
Yeah. And also, by the way, they do it for multiple items. So like if you have three items and you got to walk across the building three times, you're not going to make it in 45 minutes. So the things that they did for parallel processing, it's, they changed how everyone thought about the industry at scale. And so suddenly, like a lot of times you're buying from Amazon just because you can get it tomorrow.
Right.
And that's a massive advantage. So, and I would say there's this underappreciated one, flexibility, right? So there's a lot of systems, you know, that you are big capital intensive, you bolt them to the ground, but once you build it, you can't really change it. And, you know, it's $20 million. You're not going to just bin it, right? So the capital asset becomes this, it almost fossilizes the business in a way. So like the more modern technologies are very modular. You can add one robot, you can take a robot away, right? So like they're not tied to these big structural fixed assets. So now when it comes to labor, there's a whole bunch of things you can do, right? You see the picking arms, you see, you know, these goods to person systems where the robots bring the goods. Really, the number one thing that you can eliminate in terms of labor is walking, right? The picking, the grabbing of a thing is relatively inexpensive for a human, and a human's really good at it, right? Yeah. It's really good. But the amount of time they spend grabbing things as opposed to walking to the thing they're supposed to grab, that's the time. That's where the money is. That's where the cost is. And so one approach is to have the person stand there and bring the goods to them. That would be goods to person. The other would be where a person walks with a robot, picks, but then the robot takes it to the shipping area and eliminates the walking, the deadheading, right?
Yeah.
Those are your two biggest chunks. When you start trying to squeeze everything else out, like you're optimizing lows, you know, like you focus there first, get the walking out. That will take out 60% of the cost. And then everything else is so much harder to squeeze out, and you have to be so much you need to be so much better as an organization to optimize beyond that. But that low hanging fruit is eliminate walking.
Yeah, it's just, you know, that's great advice. It's always best to shoot for low hanging fruit. I know we had one group that tried to really fully optimize their robotics a couple of years ago, and it ended up being a huge disaster because I think they tried to bite off more than they could chew. When we're talking about, you know, designing for systems and beyond just the low hanging fruit, one of the biggest things I think you mentioned earlier was flexibility. Without putting on fully your Nostradamus hat and your crystal ball, how does one go ahead and try to develop flexible robotic systems when, you know, the future is still relatively uncertain?
Again, I think it comes down to abstraction, right? So, like, if the thing you're buying naturally is not completely intertwined with everything, or has, sometimes it's like it's a financial obligation, right? You just have $100 million on the balance sheet. You can't, you know, the CFO is just not going to write it off in 2 years, right? Right. But right now the pace of change is so darn fast that, you know, it's better to be less optimized and more flexible in the ability to alter, right? And so, I think that, again, this is why I think companies like Locus, Six Four, Ricotto have done well, because you can drop it into an existing operation. It's relatively simple for the people to onboard. The integration into the host system is relatively lightweight, right? And, you know, if they're wrong, it's not someone's career, right? Because just the capital outlay is a lot less. I would also say that the industry used to be around going to the big player. It's kind of the old IBM adage. No one got fired for buying from IBM. But in the modern world of software, more and more, you're not buying everything from one company, right? Like, you have best in class pieces of software that are tied together using what they call API technology, right? And so you can have a best in breed technical, or like a, you know, so like a CRM software without buying it from the mega company that has everything, except for everything they have is mostly just okay, right? You're stitching together the right thing for you. And the companies that can do that are the ones that can extract more value out than the ones that are just saying, I'm going to write the one big check because I want to be able to yell at one person when they go wrong. Right. So they take on that risk of, you know, having to yell at multiple people, but they're able to extract more value from the process. Right. And the other thing that does is it prevents you from having the temptation to customize the big software, because that's where the big money starts to hit you, is the customizations.
So one of the big things that we talk about when we're talking about implementing systems is understanding what to do. And a lot of that is driven by data. So I'm curious, what kind of data are you pulling from systems in the process to try to deploy as efficiently and as productively as possible?
Well, I'll answer first from a system designer, which is not what I do now, but from when I was. We would never start from a CAD drawing. We would start with a data dump from the customer. We'd say, in order to design this, you need to send us all your inventory data, all your order data for multiple years so we can see the peaks and valleys and all this stuff. And when I got started, this meant you got gigabytes of data on CD-ROMs Let's see. Yeah, you get like a FedEx box of like this many CDs, and you'd have to load it into SQL and break the data down. It almost seems quaint now. And by the way, the company, there's one company that you know, their big data server in 2004 was called Terra, because it had terabytes of data. And now I just kind of laugh at that, right? Because it's just like you go to, they have more, there's more hard drive space on the Best Buy shelf than they had back then. So like, yeah. So anywho, what you would do is look at the design patterns, and the from those data patterns, this design would emerge, and then you could start making your drawings and do your engineering calcs. But that process would take forever. Like, it would take 6 months just to analyze the data. And it also was predicated on next year being a future, this year being a good projection for next year. And that model is like harder and harder to be right up, you know, like the chances of being wrong are just higher because we are much more volatile as a consumer market, right? And drives everything. So now enter like AI, right? Like we haven't even scratched the surface on what AI is actually doing on the business side. And I think it's actually for good reason. Just the risk of hallucination at scale.
Yeah.
In your business. Like we have to be very, very careful about what we entrust to AI right now, because it's evolving so quickly, right? That there is enterprise risk to being wrong very rapidly, right? So like that's the thing about, you know, AI is super confident in its answer, right? Like, so it'll confidently be wrong. And largely it's probably because you gave it the wrong inputs, right? And so, you know, but when you look at the micro cases that are coming out, it's like, wow, we're getting some really cool outcomes. And so there was, back when we used to call it big data, which almost sounds like a silly term now. The promise was save all your data so you can do something with it, right? And bias towards saving it. So we have, I don't know how many petabytes of data out there that have been saved that are in data lakes that have been untouched, right? And it's, you know, and if you look at the ability to extract value from it, I look at it like almost think about it like an ore in the ground, right? And so you have to dig through so much ore to get to the precious metals, right? And same with this data. And a lot of companies just don't know how to do it. So what they have is digital pollution. They've got all this data they're saving, and really they're just spending money, and they're quite literally heat warming the earth, taking money from grid that could air condition people in Texas, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, it's how do you actually extract the data? And a lot of it has to do with how you store the data. Like, what happens, what do you do to the data before you put it away? Right. And most people are just throwing it in the junk closet, like randomly, right? So it's just this like big pile, right? So, and that's part of, you know, not to pitch my company, but like, we believe in normalizing data. And so that data from two different WMSs and two different buildings looks essentially the same to the consumer of that data. Also, we believe that rather these point-to-point integrations, you will publish the same data over and over to multiple companies. But, you know, if you just publish it once and you have the ability for multiple people to consume that data, multiple systems to consume that data, then suddenly you're able to do things that in real time are way more coordinated. And so I'll give you an example. We had a customer that wanted, they had picking robots. They were the type that you follow along, and they wanted to do something on the box. You know, they wanted to optimize their boxes because they're shipping a pair of yoga pants you know, in a package like this, in a box that big. Yes. Right. So what they're doing is saying there's a company that called PackSize that will take the dimensions of the materials and say, okay, you need this box, and it'll make the box on the fly according to the dimensions. Well, you need to know what the dimensions of everything is. You need to know what the, you may want to know what the optimal box size is for the method of shipping.
Yeah.
Right. You also got to know like how much dunnage you need around it. If it's shirts, no big deal. But if it's like China, like, you know, Bierstein's or whatever, like,
yeah,
probably going to want some packing material. So like how you optimize that. And then there's also, like in this case, they were also looking at, they wanted to do poly bags because poly bags are way more space efficient, right? But some things qualify to go in poly bag and some things don't, right? And so, and then once it is packaged, they want to rate shop the shipper according to the box.
Yeah.
To find out which is, so that would normally be like 6 integrations.
Yeah.
But the data needed for these are all in this essentially the same file that gets published, but they're pre-truncating the data and saying, well, you only need these 2 fields and you only need these 5 fields and you need these 3. Just publish the whole thing and then let everyone just extract the bits they need. And so suddenly you can do things what they call asynchronously. Everything's not hard coupled and tied to each other. Everyone can process independently, and then suddenly you can optimize this workflow, and the pack, you know, the guys making the boxes don't care about the picking technology anymore. They just don't need to care because it's abstracted, right? And so that's the beauty of what you can do. And like, you know, if you look at our the way we do it, the individual systems have no knowledge of the rest. All they know is they got a data payload, they got to do something with this in the back. So the irony of orchestrating multiple subsystems is that nobody could be aware of each other. So in order to orchestrate a almost like a team outcome, they can't know that there are other people on the team. And that's kind of a matrix, there is no spoon moment for people, because it goes counter to the way most people think about it. Yeah. Sorry if I'm going like nerd level 7 or 10.
No. Like, we have a lot of nerds. We have a lot of nerds that listen to this podcast. So I would say that would be real estate nerds and business nerds are our chief demographic. So that's fine. Talking about there is no spoon and the whole idea of, you know, that we have kind of unique concepts and paradoxes. One of the biggest paradoxes that, going back to data, is do you think we record too much data generally? Because like I find that, at least on the sales side, we have a lot of customers that we go out and talk to, and their data harvesting process that they're harvesting all sorts of data, as you mentioned, and then at the end of the day, there's not that much to do with it. Or do you think it's a process where they're just not recording it the right way? Because I know with our own processes, we spent a tremendous amount of time cleaning up the data inputs, and then we found valuable data. Do you think it's one of those two issues, or am I getting this totally wrong?
No, you're right. And you're wrong. It's not that. So, all right. So it is silly to record everything if you aren't going to use it, period. All right. Yeah. It's also, if all you want to know is what happened, then you really don't. You can be kind of lightweight on your data. You can say, I only want to know that this happened, yes or no, right? So what I call it is red light, green light data, right? In other words, I was supposed to ship this many. Did I ship it, right? That's pretty easy. I know what feels a grab. You can decide, I don't need all the rest, I just need this. If that's all you want, then great. The problem is that when the problem with getting answers out of data is it usually prompts more questions. And that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Right?
So the classic scenario is you go to IT and say, I want to know the answer. I want to know about my business. Send me the data. And they're like, well, what questions do you want answered? I don't know. Well, give me a list before I'll even start. Right. So next thing you know, you're thinking about it. And the first you send it, it's like 6 months later, you finally get the report. You're like, okay, wow, that's really cool. What happened that day? We need the answer to that. Well, we didn't store that data, but we don't even understand the exact question. So why don't you write out that question? And we can't answer the data from, you know, yesterday, but we can answer it tomorrow after we deploy it in 6 months, like the tomorrow plus 6 months, right? So like this pace of being able to learn from your business and to drill down, that is very dependent upon the fidelity of the data and the amount of data you have back in time to find trends. And so I look at this as like this, the data wisdom continuum, where you have data. No one wants data. People want information. They want knowledge. They want wisdom, right? But if you don't have data, you can't have the rest, right? And so this is how humans learn. We learn by accumulating data, and eventually you become wise, right? Or some of us do. And but like if you then look at this, wow, I want to double click. This was a bad day. You want to know why it happened. Why was it a bad day? Well, you need to know how it happened. In order to know how it happened, you need to have much more fidelity of data. And one of the problems with like black box integrations is if you have two black boxes of data that you have trouble getting data out of, the best place to grab that data is in the data exchange, right? Problem is that, you know, custom integrations means that you have two black boxes and two black pipes that touch each other. Yeah. There's no real way to get any value of that data. And so, and I believe in transparent boxes, and I believe in transparent pipes, right? Like you're paying for that data. You should get it, and you should get it at the highest fidelity level you desire. Because if you do want to double click into it, you can, right? And, you know, and I know my team all the time, because I'll ask a question and then I'm like asking why seven times, right? But that's how you actually get better as a business, is to understand why things happen, not just what. There was actually, I was doing a Gemba walk with a EVP of supply chain for one of the largest wine companies on earth. And it was really cool. He was going through all the departments, and normally they focus on what went bad, but then we got to this one guy who had an amazing day or amazing week the week before. And this VP is like, wow, that's awesome. Like, what did you guys do to make it that much better? And the guy is like, I don't know. It just was better. Right. So like, it's not just the bad things you can learn from. Like, he wasn't aware of what was good, what made it good, because he didn't understand why. He just knew that it happened. He was like so stoked to report that he had an amazing week. And then when the boss asked him why, he's like, and he kind of, it completely dashed his hopes on the rocks. And so, you know, this is what you can, this is why the data is important. So yes, like if you're not going to use it, then stop taking air conditioning electricity from the Texans, right? Like, but if you are really serious about doing it, yeah, you need to have an integrated data strategy that is very thoughtful, and you need to understand that you want to do the forensics, that it's part of your culture to do the forensic analysis post, you know, as a natural thing, not just as an exception.
So for all the real estate, Yeah. So for all the real estate investors listening right now, and we've talked a lot about and gotten into the weeds, getting close to starting to wrap it up in kind of a package that, you know, they can maybe better understand. Where do you think investor blind spots are the biggest regarding how real estate investors and entrepreneurs and business owners perceive that tech integration? Like, what do you think they get wrong the most?
And this is a real estate lens, right? So here's what I'll say. Like, one of our investors is Prologis Ventures, right? So Prologis, the largest builder of real estate.
I think everyone listening knows who Prologis is. Yeah.
There you go. And the guy on my board, Todd Lewis, who you should talk to someday, right? Like, he's amazing. They have decided that they cannot be four walls and a roof anymore, right? They have to be more than that. And if you look at how real estate's bought, it usually has no technical people in the contractual agreement sales. Like, it's we're selling land, four walls and a roof and a floor, right? Like, so, it's what the building is designed. It's going to go do something. It's not just going to sit there, right? And so more and more, they're investing companies that enable them to be more than four walls and a roof, right? And that, I think they were talking about this 5 years ago. And like, so they've been ahead of this game. And so I'd say the blind spot is just four walls and a roof. If that's all the way you're thinking, then at some point it's going to tip on you and you might be on the outside looking in.
Yeah. So, that's a lot of the conversations we've had on this podcast. I think real estate is going to be more tech and more hospitality moving forward. And, regarding where you end up on that spectrum depends on your asset class. I'd love to move
go ahead. Maybe a way to think about it is, what does your customer's customer intend to do with this?
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
So like, if you think one to two steps downstream, then you can start to say, okay, well, then this is an offering that can stream through. And by the way, like, it's less commoditized. Your margins can go up if you do it well, right? And so, you know, because if it's just price per square foot, then you're really just in a reverse auction.
Yeah. Right. So let's dive into that more into our final four. So our final four is always a good wrap up, and it's a good point to learn a little bit more about you, a little bit more about what you do, your business, and kind of how you see the world moving forward. Because we find that men and women who are in the arena tend to know where the world's going to be 5 and 10 years out, often way before even some of the investors that listen to this podcast. So what do you think is going to have changed the most about robotics 5 to 10 years out?
That's a good question. You know, I could say, I can just do say humanoid and AI as a, just to check the box answer. But I think what will happen is that companies in the robotics industry will focus more on making it accessible to your mid-pack buyer, right?
Yeah.
Because right now you really have to be super skilled. You have to have robotics capability inside your company in order to be qualified to buy from robotics companies. That we're never going to get mass adoption without that. And so, and then once all that's working and we focus on creating transparent boxes, transparent pipes, then you can start having inter value exchange, which means 1 + 1 + 1 = 50, right? And that's, you know, and that's what we're striving for, is to provide that part of the thing. So that's my answer.
So one of the things that we always like to have as an answer on the podcast is we have a lot of younger listeners too, a lot of younger real estate nerds. And I'd say anybody, you know, in their 20s, maybe early 30s qualifies, and they're in various points starting off their career. And they're often looking for advice from some of the other folks that we bring on, including yourself, who have had success. And I'm curious if you could give a 1 minute bit of advice to a younger AK, what would it be?
Well, personally, I would have started a company earlier. you know, like I would have started my journey before I was, you know, I had gray hair. But I'd also say that, like, just be insanely curious and just keep asking why, keep digging and keep leaning in. Don't expect to be spoon fed, right? Just be aggressive. And no matter, I don't care if we're in the world of AI, if we're in the world of stone tablets, the people who are insanely curious are the ones who transform things. And it's the people who want to understand the invisible, is that quote, only those who can see the invisible can do the impossible, right? Strive to understand what is the underlying magic.
I do that. That's not an oddity on here. Many of the individuals we brought on, the number one thing they're pushing is curiosity. And that we always try to ask why on this podcast. Very rarely, though, we do also ask what. And what should we be picking up in terms of our next book? It could be as simple as a children's book. It could be as complex as War and Peace. You know, what's the next book that we should be picking up?
So I thought about, you had asked me this, and I thought about this. I'm going to give you two really old books.
Okay. All right.
The Goal by Goldratt, which is essentially a novel about how to do math in a business and optimize throughput and profit. Right? It's a really good book, and it puts it in context. The Design of Everyday Things by Don Norman. Like, this is a book that talks about how to make things simple for your customer, not make simple things, make it more simple for you, right? That keep it simple, stupid thing. Most people are saying, keep it simple for myself, and I'll just push complexity to you, right? And this is really the difference between Apple and other companies, right? They push simplicity to their customers, but they absorb and ingest the complexity, because ability to convert complex to simple is really where competitive advantage is derived, in my opinion. And then finally, because all these are books that were the art and science blend, right?
Yeah.
And the final one is a more recent book called Brain Rules, which is a neuroscience book on how the human brain operates, but it's really done well and written for people, you know, like knuckle draggers like me, to be able to understand neuroscience without getting a medical degree. And most chapters start with some guy in England getting stabbed in the brain with a railroad spike or getting hit with a club. And like, suddenly he starts forgetting stuff. Like, so it's fascinating. And I believe that ultimately, no matter how high tech it is, this is a people at the heart of everything. Trust is at the heart of everything. And if you don't invest in the understanding the people side, then you will always fall short.
A business is a people business, at least most of the time. This goes into our last question, which is the whole reason for the podcast. And we're firm believers in that the men and women that are in real estate spaces and tech spaces and public policy spaces, that they tend to know the next person to reach out to. So who should be the next person we bring on the podcast?
I think Todd Lewis would be a great one, right? He, again, Prologis would be it'd be straight down the fairway for you guys, but the things that they're doing, they're pushing the envelope. And I think there's a lot to learn from them.
Look, I'd love to reach out to Todd. If somebody wants to reach out to you, what's the best way to get in touch?
You know, we have just go to the website, contact information, or you can send me a note on LinkedIn and we'll get you to the right people.
Well, we'll put the website in the comments. AK, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Thanks again to AK. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, subscriptions, and interactions truly matter, and they help us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lamphere of the Real Finance Podcast, and thank you for listening.